You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on Thursday, the 1st of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Oscar Guardiola Rivera. He'll be leading us through the three stories we'll be keeping our eyes on during the course of today. Oscar, what do you have for us?
We have the age of the whistleblower.
Oscar, thank you. We will speak to Oscar very shortly. Also coming up, it was a contract killing that sent shockwaves through Malaysia. We'll ask if the murder of a bank chief is just the latest bloody chapter in Malaysia's rising violent crime story, and whether the government in Kuala Lumpur is trying to keep the figures quiet.
And in Europe, August is a month when the continent shuts down for the summer. We'll ask how this mass vacation evacuation impacts the continent's economy, and we'll see how it compares to other parts of the world.
According to the Brazilian law, the minimum of your holidays should be 10 days. So basically, if you have a marriage on a Friday, you can't go.
And? Keeping with the holiday theme, we'll bring you the fourth of our postcards from world leaders as they embark on their summer holidays. Today, we'll be in Britain and ask where Queen Elizabeth and Prime Minister David Cameron will be spending their summer. They won't be together.
Not as far as we know, anyway. All that, plus we'll play some great music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So coming up to 8:02 a.m. here in London, that's the next hour here on Monocle 24. We'll get started with Barney Burnham. He's got your headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. A source in Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party is claiming victory in Zimbabwe's presidential election. The unnamed source told Reuters that the party had resoundingly beaten Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change. The MDC claims there's been monumental fraud and is said to be holding an emergency meeting today. The early release of results is illegal, and police say anyone making premature claims about the result will be arrested. A former nurse has been jailed for life for deliberately starting two fires that killed 11 people at a nursing home in Sydney in November 2011. Earlier this year, Roger Dean admitted starting the fires in an attempt to cover up his theft of drugs from the Quakers Hill nursing home. He admitted 11 counts of murder and 8 of recklessly causing grievous bodily harm. Many relatives of the victims were in court to hear sentence being passed. Ellie Valkai's 90-year-old mother, Nelcha, died in the blaze.
I can finally breathe again. It's been nearly 2 years and holding our breath, and now all this is over with and never to be released. Oh, life, wonderful. And I hope he suffers as much in jail as my mother suffered the last 4 days of her life, which was horrendous.
The United Nations says Syria has given permission for its investigators to visit three sites where chemical weapons have allegedly been used. In a statement from his office, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the investigators would visit the sites as soon as possible. One of those they'll be visiting is Khan al-Asal outside Aleppo, where 27 people were killed in attacks allegedly involving chemical weapons earlier this year. It was under government control in March but fell to the rebels last week. The other two sites to be investigated haven't been named, but they're believed to be near Homs and Damascus. Supporters of Egypt's ousted President Mohamed Morsi are defying a warning from the country's interim leaders by continuing their sit-in at a mosque in Cairo. The army-backed cabinet has ordered police in the capital to end long-running protests at two sites, but the Muslim Brotherhood says it has no alternative but to continue the sit-in, which has already lasted a month. US State Department Deputy Spokeswoman Mari Harf says America firmly believes in the right to protest.
Well, we've continued to urge the interim government, officials and security forces to respect the right of peaceful assembly. That obviously includes sit-ins. So we've made that point publicly and privately, and we'll continue to do so.
Was it communicated specifically in this instance?
I don't know about these specific demonstrations that we're referring to, the specific sit-in, but we've broadly speaking made that point from the very beginning, and we'll continue to do so.
The Kenyan president has officially opened a summit of African leaders in Nairobi, and the fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo is set to dominate talks. Uhuru Kenyatta made the opening speech at the International Conference for the Great Lakes region. The eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo has been plagued by conflict for years, and it's currently undergoing intense international scrutiny as the local army, backed by UN troops, battles armed groups in the mineral-rich area. Mr. Kenyatta hopes a peace deal can be found.
Kenya therefore pledges its full support to the establishment and work of the Joint Intelligence Fusion Center and urges that the center be strengthened to spearhead expeditious implementation of the Protocol on Non-Aggression and Mutual Defense. Kenya also welcomes the Peace, Security and Cooperation Framework for the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the entire region.
Lawmakers in Uruguay have backed a bill to legalize marijuana. Following a 13-hour debate, 50 of the 96 members of the House of Representatives approved the bill. If it's passed by the Senate, only the government would be allowed to sell the drug, and Uruguay would become the only country to regulate its production, distribution and sale. The bill's supported by the country's president, who says it'll divert users from hard drugs and do away with profits for drug dealers. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. Barney will be back in a little under half an hour to bring us a quick roundup of what's going on in the world. In the meantime, though, you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. We are live from Studio One and we are in London. Time now to set the day's news agenda. Three big stories we'll be following throughout the day here on Monocle 24. And joining us today for his big three, Oscar Guardiola-Ribera from Birkbeck University here in London. Oscar, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Well, it's nice to see you. You're looking, you've sort of adjusted your well-dressed vibe towards the summertime.
I'm ready to go out there.
Is there a separate wardrobe?
No, these is my wardrobe. The other one is the one that I never want to see.
A summer collection and a wind collection.
Yes.
Indeed. Okay, well, let's start with whistleblowing and Bradley Manning.
It is the age of the whistleblower. There are two of the main three stories for today that confirm that. The first one has to do with Manning's conviction. He is, as we all know, the source of the WikiLeaks trove of secret disclosures, and he's now facing a possible maximum sentence of 136 years in military jail. He was convicted on Tuesday of most charges on which he stood trial. His judge, Colonel Dennis Lind, delivered her verdict in court in pointed language. Guilty, 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 she repeated over and over as the reality of a prolonged prison sentence for Manning dawned.
There is this unusual thing that he was convicted under this 1917 Act. Which I think no one apart from no non-spy has ever been convicted under it.
He's the first investigative journalist, in fact, to be or the first person to be convicted for leaking under the 1917 Act.
What does it say about the direction that the Obama administration is taking?
It makes it absolutely clear that the Obama administration is waging war on whistleblowers, that whistleblowing is now being redefined not only as leaking documents in the service of public interest, but also as spying. And this, of course, will send chills not only throughout the digital hacker and whistleblower community, but also in the press.
I guess the reverse of sending chills, whatever that is, sending some sort of warmth, is possibly there because this charge of aiding the enemy wasn't one which came to fruition. So presumably had aiding the enemy, which is this very serious sort of this very rarely used charge, but very serious in the extreme, if that had come to fruition, that would have had a very chilling effect on journalism full stop, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Some viewers might remember that former US ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, actually asked for the death penalty to be applied in this case. And the seriousness of a charge such as aiding the enemy would have brought this case closer to such extremes. Indeed, there is some, warmth, as you put it, in the fact that Lind decided not to charge Manning with this particular conviction. But then again, she found him guilty of leaking Afghan and Iraq war logs and embassy cables and Guantanamo files, with reason to believe such information could be used to the injury of the U.S. or the advantage of any foreign nation.
I mean, talking about,
as closer as you can get.
But they're saying that Manning did widespread damage to U.S. operations. But at what point do you have to start to distinguish between the person who does the leaking and the person who does the publishing? Because in the case of Snowden, who obviously strikes me as a more psychologically stronger character than Manning, you have them going to publishers, WikiLeaks, the Guardian, who then make the decision to publish. And that is perhaps the bit where does the US tackle that particular problem? Because they're trying to go after the little guys. It's the big guys who have the ability to get the information out there.
It is very difficult to make a distinction, or at least such a distinction, because in fact, pretty much everyone can nowadays publish a mass of documents online. In that sense, the whistleblower or the leaker and publisher are becoming one and the same person. And what this particular conviction means is that this will be a precedent for charging the big guys, as you put it. We all know that there has been a grand jury investigation on WikiLeaks. There are four people already convicted as whistleblowers, all of them using these sort of media outlets. And here the other problem is, as Julian Assange put it yesterday, reacting to this conviction, that this verdict sets a dangerous precedent, an example of, as he put it, national security extremism.
It arguably sets a dangerous precedent to the United States, but to what degree are we going to see sort of legal contagion happen now? I mean, can you see a situation where, for example, the European Union, which has incredibly strong principles in terms of right to privacy and public interest and what have you, can you see the EU adopting a similar approach to this, or individual countries such as the United Kingdom picking up on this?
I would say that it is more likely that individual countries such as the UK will pick up on this. The EU will be more reluctant to rein in on privacy, as it has happened in the US. Having said that, we have seen in a series of cases, an erosion of civil liberties throughout the world, in fact, mainly in Europe and America. And so, this is indeed a dire precedent.
Oscar, when I was about 11, there was a program at school called X Key Score, which I think was trying to teach me to touch type. I think it was called that. But now I discover that X Key Score has turned into a monster that's watching us all.
Absolutely, absolutely the case.
What are you talking about?
There was a program at school that was called X Key Score. It used to teach me to touch type. This is a very different thing, clearly.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I'm pretty sure that somebody, made this joke on us, and the joke is indeed on us. This is Snowden's latest revelation, according to some documents provided by Edward Snowden. It seems the NSA has a program called X Key Score, which it calls its widest reaching system for developing intelligence from the web. To put it in very simple terms, and citing Snowden, I, sitting at my desk, could wiretap anyone from you or your accountant to a federal judge or even the president if I had a personal email.
Surely, if I were a private company who was responsible for the operation of my client's emails, I would want to have something to say about that.
They must have something to say about that. But all we have seen so far is disclaimers that, we're not in bed with the government, that we're not trying to do that. And yet evidence keeps mounting and mounting to the contrary, that in fact the government has now the capacity, and here I'm quoting again another document, using this program to cover nearly everything a typical user does on the internet, which means that I shouldn't worry anymore about my girlfriend, lurking into my computer. The NSA already knows it.
That's fine. I'll pass it on to her.
That's another topic for another day, Oscar.
I wonder, the way that the NSA revelations are going, it seems that that there is talk of what lawmakers might do to change the way that these sort of government agencies are operating. But at each step, it seems nothing is actually being done, that there's sort of a PR war being fought for the NSA to go, hoping everyone will sort of not do anything now so we can kind of carry on doing this forever.
That's exactly what they're doing. I mean, we know that throughout the week, many of them, in particular General Alexander, has been before the Senate committee. What he has said so far is that the allegations of wrongdoing do not check out. But against what would you check them out?
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio.
Coming up next, we will be in Malaysia to assess the fallout of a brutal contract killing that's casting a spotlight on the apparent rise in violent crime in the country. That's after this.
If design is your beat, then tune into Section D, our weekly show delving deep into the latest developments in the worlds of architecture, fashion, furniture, product development, tech, and many more.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
No matter what the sphere, we'll be here with expert insights, news, and exclusive interviews on all things design. So switch on to Section D every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
Now, it was a killing in cold blood. 75-year-old Hussein Ahmad Najdi, the founder of the Arab Malaysian Development Bank, one of Malaysia's largest financial institutions, had just emerged from a temple in the capital of Kuala Lumpur when gunmen opened fire, killing him and injuring his wife.
Investigators believe it was a contract killing. The gunman fled the scene in a taxi, according to local media. The murder of Mr. Najdi has brought into sharp focus an apparent spike in crime of exactly this sort in Malaysia. The government, however, which was re-elected under the leadership of Prime Minister Najib Razak, claims that crime is falling in the country, an assertion that feels on the ground at least increasingly hollow. Well, Emily Ford, Monocle's contributor in Shanghai, has been covering the story and she joins us on the line now. Emily, thanks for joining us this morning. Give us an idea of exactly what happened in this killing.
Well, it was really quite shocking. On Monday, Hussein Ahmad Najdi, who's a retired, a very prominent banker who founded the Arab Malaysian Bank, he was basically gunned down after going to a lunch meeting in Kuala Lumpur on Monday. In broad daylight, he was shot with his wife. He was killed and she's in a reasonably serious condition, as I understand it.
We have this situation, therefore, of an international banker being killed in what appears to be a contract killing. We mentioned a moment ago that there are concerns that crime is rising in Malaysia, but this now adds a big international element to it. I mean, how bad was the situation within the country before the rest of the world suddenly got to know about it?
I mean, I think it's something that's been simmering for a while. You know, there's been a string of, fairly high-profile shootings that have suddenly, as you say, you know, kind of switched the world's attention onto this issue. But, you know, at a sort of more, ordinary level, there's been, you know, a very noticeable rise in muggings, in burglaries, in armed robberies of restaurants and convenience stores, for example. And people are really becoming, you know, quite afraid of this this rise in crime. And so I think it's something that's been... steadily, you know, gathering speed for a couple of years now.
But at the same time, we've got the government whistling an entirely different tune and saying that our statistics say everything's actually improving. So is there a bit of a trust breakdown occurring here?
I mean, Prime Minister Najib Razak made fighting crime a, you know, high-profile priority a few years ago under his economic transformation program. They say that the official statistics show that overall crime has fallen by 27% since 2009. But the fact that, you know, ordinary people's experience and perception doesn't bear this out means that there's increasingly suggestions that the official statistics are being, you know, doctored or manipulated in some way. And you're seeing a rise in independent websites, blogs, encouraging people to report incidents. You know, there's a Malaysia crime awareness group on Facebook that has tens of thousands of members posting video footage, dates and times of incidents. And it all suggests there is rather a gulf in trust in what the government's saying and doing about this rise in crime.
To what degree is an argument being introduced that the police might be involved in this? The police watchdog is currently in hospital, having been shot and seriously injured. You mentioned all these blogs, but is there an attempt to suppress any kind of discussion of this problem?
I mean, there definitely seems to be the suggestion. The gentleman you mentioned, Sri Sanjeevin, was shot last Saturday. Now, he was running an anti-crime watchdog NGO group called My Watch, looking into the involvement of the police in crime. He's accused the Malaysian authorities of manipulating crime data, and the reports in the media are saying that he was planning to actually expose the links of police with drug syndicates. There definitely seems to be suggestions that the police are somehow complicit in this and that they're not going after, you know, the big fish who perhaps sort of run organized crime rings. And this is also being borne out by international groups such as Human Rights Watch, who've said that, you know, they've called the Malaysian police force a fourth world police force. Transparency International say that they're, you know, 4 out of 5 on the corruption scale. So this is definitely a strong suggestion here.
So on the one hand, we've got the stats saying one thing. On the other, we've got people experiencing a very different level of sort of criminality. Where does that leave the Prime Minister? Because he didn't have the sort of strongest of political footholds in the first place, did he?
No, I mean, Prime Minister Najib Razak had to fight a very bitter battle to get re-elected in May. He was narrowly re-elected, but his majority was greatly reduced. And this potentially presents a real, you know, political crisis for him, a real crisis of public confidence. He seems to be aware of that. He's made some very tough comments in recent days, you know, pledging to tackle the rise in crime. He's proposing new legislation. But I think people are lacking in confidence. They don't particularly trust the government. And so he's going to have to show that he's taking some real concrete actions to restore trust. The opposition politicians are calling for an independent police complaints commission, and perhaps that would be something that would go some way to restoring public confidence.
Emily Ford in Shanghai there.
Now, here in Europe, summer is upon us, and as European tradition has it, the continent will effectively shut down for the month. Parliaments will go on recess. Businesses will be run by a skeleton staff, while the hotels, resorts and beachside residences will be brimming with those taking a summer break.
And in many cities, the streets are either filled with tourists or the stubborn few determined not to leave. It's a closure of a continent in all but name, so what effect does this have on its business affairs? In a moment, we'll speak to our very own David Michon on his recent Monocle essay on why a month's holiday is as good a thing for a company as it is for a continent. But here are two voices first from two parts of the world where summer is welcomed quite differently.
First, it's Monocle's Marcus Hippie on how Northern Europe does things a little differently than the rest of the continent.
In Finland, all the workers are kind of competing who gets to take the whole of July off. That's when people don't want to work. That's basically when Finland shuts down. It may be gradually changing. It was a couple of months ago when a Swedish researcher suggested that it may be better having two-week holidays instead of having one whole month, as people so often do. The benefit being that when you return from a holiday, regardless of the actual length, it doesn't really matter if you've been away for 2 weeks or 4 weeks. It only takes about a week and you're back in the same mold at work. So if you take two two-week holidays, you basically feel more energized.
I bet you do, Marcus. But in Brazil, holidays are far more restricted. Monocle's resident Brazilian. I didn't know we had a job title like that. Great job. Fernanda Augusta Pacheco explains.
Basically, in Brazil, what is nice about Europe is that you have flexibility on your holiday. So you can take one day off this week and the next week you can take another day off. But according to the Brazilian law, you can only have the minimum of your holiday should be 10 days. So basically, if you have a marriage on a Friday, you can't go. Usually Brazilians, they take like 20 days off in one portion of time. Usually that's in December, but the employee has to decide that. So I think it's quite strict. But then on the other hand, as I was telling you, I just realized that we have plenty of national holidays, and which is a kind of a good thing and a bad thing, because it's kind of bad for our economy. But then we have Carnival, we have Virgin Mary's Day, we have the Day of the Proclamation of the Republic. Name a month and I can tell you that we have a couple of holidays there.
Thank you, Fernando. Thank you, Marcus. And David Michon is here now to unpick this issue a little further.
Hello.
David, hello. You wrote an essay on the benefits of Europe's August shutdown.
The North American comes in and says, let's all go on holiday.
This is what happens when you write an essay. We drag you into the studio.
This is also what happens when you're sitting in the office and it's 30 degrees outside and just absolutely sunny and cloudless.
Yeah. This is your viva, David.
What do I want right now?
We mentioned there that the European inside from Marcus, and then the Fernando Augusta Pacheco approach, which seems to be a general holiday approach anyway, rain or shine. But they are two rather different approaches, and you sort of straddling the Atlantic, as it were.
What long legs you've got.
What is the sort of the mental perception of long and short holidays?
Well, yeah. So in North America, of course, people are offered a lot fewer holidays compared to Europe. And the general perception of a North American of the European style of holiday just by sheer volume, let alone the idea that a continent kind of shuts down for a period of 4 weeks, or a country shuts down for a period of 4 weeks, is that it's, you know, absolute laziness. It's kind of like completely toying with your economy. And in fact, you know, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you can just take the example of Germany. You know, there are obviously a lot of other factors which kind of dictate a country's economic productivity. And, you know, there have been several studies kind of over the past years, one by Ernst & Young last year, which focused on the U.S. Found that, in fact, the more holidays that Americans took, the more productive they were. But that, in fact, Americans weren't even taking the limited number of holidays that they were offered. So that's just kind of the aside of the economics. I think, you know, there's not necessarily an argument that you know, as little as holiday as possible means more productivity.
It is that thing, though, that if you let's say take Europe and you take Germany, as you mentioned there, you have big companies there who say, okay, we're shutting down production for the whole of August. And as a result, you have all the supply chain there, which has to, therefore, either make hay and sort of squirrel away their products, or they too say, well, we're not going to get any work this month. We may as well go on holiday. It has a sort of commonsensical element to it if it is dominated by a big company. But is there not the argument that if you are a small company of fewer than 100 people, to try and shut down could actually mean that you really do find yourself as a disadvantage because there are too few of you to keep up with you know, the rest of the world?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, if you think about kind of really small businesses, kind of the entrepreneurial ventures, then in fact, you know, they might, you know, there's a difficult, you know, you don't necessarily have cover. If you're a really small business, there isn't necessarily kind of the manpower to shift things around and continue operations. So if you want any holiday at all, you've kind of got to take it. So why not just everyone in the country take it at the same time? You're exactly right. I mean, it's nice. I mean, in the essay I wrote, it was kind of a little bit more selfish.
I love it, actually.
And it's just about the idea of, you know, an entire company, you know, leaving the office, all having, you know, a bit of fresh air and a bit of escape at the same time, where you're not worried about things happening back at the office, decisions being made, and you can just come back all being refreshed and all ready to kind of muck in.
And it seems it trends in sort of the way holidays are deployed or not. Certainly in North America, I've heard anecdotally of a few people who've got jobs over there recently, friends of mine, who don't have a holiday entitlement whatsoever. There is a sort of zero holiday policy whereby you can take holiday if you've done everything that you need to do. Yeah. And of course, that's at first seems like you're going to be on holiday permanently. And what it practically means is you never take any holiday.
Yeah, of course. And there are some companies that, you know, don't even, you know, have a holiday allowance until you've worked there for at least a year or something.
There is that difference, though, between the idea of taking a holiday and then being plagued from the office by emails. Yeah. What, very briefly, are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there needs to be a, you know, again, I think there just needs to be a moment where you can completely escape. And I think that, in fact, you know, that does help your productivity and encourages creativity, because everyone is, you know, you're not, you have some space and distance to think about things critically.
David Michon, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio.
We'll stay with the summer theme before we join Barney for the news at 4:30 with our fourth postcard from our correspondents around the world on where some heads of government are going on their summer holes this year.
Today, Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards tells us where Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, please be upstanding, and her Prime Minister David Cameron are going this year on their summer holidays, not summer holiday together.
Nominally, of course, the head of state is Queen Elizabeth, not even David Cameron at all. But she seems to get a bit more leeway from the public in terms of her vacation plans. And in fact, if you think back recently, we've seen the royal baby arriving. The Queen entertained royal watchers by suggesting that she wanted her great-grandson to hurry up and get born because it was delaying her holiday. But people just said, oh, what an old character she is, QE2, even though she was delayed from her two measured month vacation.
We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a week or two.
And she goes up to Balmoral in Scotland, of course. Beautiful estate there. But of course, she's been saying, well, look, this is actually quite good for the country. Royal baby, little Prince George. And you hardly needed the royal family to give much encouragement to the likes of David Cameron, to himself to try and get in on the act and suggest that this summer, instead of a time for break, was a time for the nation to thrive, the economy to get a much-needed boost from the new arrival.
It's been a remarkable few years for our royal family, a royal wedding that captured people's hearts, that extraordinary and magnificent jubilee, and they can know that a proud nation is celebrating with a very proud and happy couple tonight.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister, Nick Dakin.
Question number one, Mr. Speaker.
The cutthroat world of contemporary politics. He's already got quite a lot of stick, David Cameron. He's taking three breaks during the long parliamentary recess this summer. And he's tried to make a great deal of capital from the fact that he's staying here in Blighty. He's going to Cornwall. He said if his kids had their choice, they'd only go to Cornwall because they love it so dearly. He's also going to Scotland, possibly nice for a summer break if you're that way inclined. But then he's also going to Portugal. And this is where he's incurred the wrath and ire of particularly a number of Labour members of Parliament who are suggesting, you know, it just shows how out of touch, you know, David Cameron is, that he can take three breaks when most hardworking families would be hard pushed even to take one holiday. Within that, he's still mindful of the PR, so he has gone off to Portugal, but he's taken EasyJet. He's done this before. You'll remember a couple of years ago, he went to Grenada. Again, he flew on the budget airline. I mean, my personal view is that the public is kind of savvy enough to realise that this is gesture politics. Cameron, despite his background, you know, sort of Eton, Oxbridge, he's more sensitive about that, it appears, at least. And he avoids these great villas. He's not staying in any palatial palazzos by the Italian lakes, for example. No one else is spared, so he's obviously part of a coalition government at the moment. And Nick Clegg, his deputy, leader of the Liberal Democrats, he's also received quite a lot of criticism because he's also vacationing in Europe. He's gone, he has a second home in Spain, of course, where his wife is from. But it is interesting. What I find interesting is the language. Critics of Cameron and of the government say typical Tory government, just completely ignoring the Liberal Democrats altogether, which is perhaps they're damned by the fact that they cozied up to the Tories in this deal in the first place. I think politically, his holiday making won't be too damaging. He's probably hoping to get a baby bounce to try and maybe mimic the good news that he had last summer when the Olympics seemed to bring so much goodwill to the streets of Britain. I don't think he'll be too concerned about where things are headed, and probably the Liberal Democrats have more to worry about.
The toe-tapping sounds of Tom Edwards and Cliff Richard there on the holiday plans of British Prime Minister David Cameron.
We hear of Shinzo Abe's plans tomorrow, but first, with the time at just approaching 34 minutes past the hour, Barney has the latest.
Thanks, Emma. A source in Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF is claiming that the party has resoundingly beaten Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change in Zimbabwe's election. The MDC claims there's been monumental fraud and is holding an emergency meeting today. A former nurse has been jailed for life for deliberately starting two fires that killed 11 people at a nursing home in Sydney in November 2011. Earlier this year, Roger Dean admitted starting the fires in an attempt to cover up his theft of drugs from the home. The United Nations says Syria has given permission for its investigators to visit three sites where chemical weapons have allegedly been used. In a statement from his office, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the investigators would visit the sites as soon as possible. Supporters of Egypt's ousted President Mohamed Morsi have defied a warning from the country's interim leaders by continuing their sit-in at a mosque in Cairo. The army-backed cabinet has ordered police in the capital to end long-running protests at two sites. The Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has officially opened a summit of African leaders in Nairobi. The fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo is set to dominate talks at the International Conference for the Great Lakes region. And lawmakers in Uruguay have backed a bill to legalise marijuana. If passed by the Senate, only the government would be allowed to sell the drug, and Uruguay would become the only country in the world to regulate its production, distribution and sale. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Emma Nelson. Now, this week, The Urbanist, our weekly show about the cities we live in, of course, is taking a look at glass. Over the past 60 years, it's taken over our skylines, becoming the default cladding in a tall building boom.
Andrew Tuck will find out who the lovers and haters of the material are, and in New York, we'll take a peek through the windows of high-rise workspaces to see what the neighbours are up to. In this preview of the programme, however, Andrew sets up the topic by inviting Virginia McLeod, author of The Detail on Contemporary Glass Architecture, into the studio to see things a little more clearly.
Virginia, I wanted to start with a very simple point. What glass represents? I guess when we look back at some of the buildings that sprung up in the 50s and the 60s, especially when you think of skyscrapers in America, they kind of represented transparency, openness. It seemed to be a moment where corporate culture, for example, changed, that businesses wanted you to know what they were up to, it seemed, or they implied that anyway, with these big glass buildings. Do you think that glass is much more than a material? Do you think it does tell stories? Does it represent things that people are trying to achieve, whether it's with their domestic life or with their corporate life?
Yes, I think it very much does so, I mean, both sort of the corporate world and domestic world and every type of building in between. Glass offers transparency in its literal sense, and as you suggested, in a corporate sense, people might be want to seem to be transparent, and glass sort of illustrates that. And because it's so transparent, it offers a sort of a beguiling quality that people don't seem to be able to resist. So it's clean and it's sort of crystalline and it's just so attractive that I think people want it for those sorts of reasons. But they also want it because it's such a high-tech product these days. So while it was doing those things in the 50s and 60s, now it does so much more. So it still offers those things to, say, corporate developers and homeowners and everyone in between. But because it's so high-tech and offers sort of solar protection and thermal insulation, self-cleaning, there's the ability to spray on solar cells now so that the building can generate power through its glass. It offers so much sort of technologically that it's pretty hard to resist.
Is there a balance, though? Because, you know, we've seen, for example, in some of the cities of America and Canada, where every building seems to have an amazing glass front on it, and every street, every store is just kind of cold glass at the front. Sometimes that feels a little bit kind of austere, and you know, you kind of hanker after the days when there was a bit more wood involved as well, and there was a bit more kind of identity to those street fronts. What's the balance, do you think, between using glass to be very modern, as you say, a very contemporary product, but also kind of knowing when to not use it in a way and realising that sometimes it's a bit brutal?
Oh, definitely. I think so many architects are moving towards stone and wood in particular and brick as a way to sort of combat that coldness. You certainly see that in domestic architecture where glass is used far more judiciously, where it's used in specific positions around the building to highlight a view or bring in light from a particular direction, north or south, for example. And then timber or stone is used as sort of the feature material, if you like. That's not so easy on larger buildings for structural reasons and also performance issues. Structurally, you can only get so much out of stone before it just won't stand up. Brick, wood as well. So sometimes timber will be used in bigger buildings as a lightweight, non-structural cladding for the same aesthetic reasons, to bring some sort of softness and textural quality to it and just alleviate some of that cold crystalline sense, which you might not want for an entire building.
And it's interesting you talk about the technology that's available with glass now, but it sometimes does seem to be used poorly. For example, I went to a project recently which was an amazing penthouse where they had a kind of big glass box on the top of the house. One, it was so hot, it was unbelievable, even though they had the air conditioning on. And actually, when you looked at the furnishings in the apartment, they were all bleached to hell. Now, do you think that that kind of glass box addition that we've seen, you know, dropped on buildings all across London, for example, when you go to the East End of London, if you're high enough up and you look out across the city, it seems every building has a little glass box now dropped on the top. Do we always understand how to use glass in that sense, do you think?
No, we definitely don't. And like any other material or any other design, used poorly, it will be a major problem for the people who are living with it or working in it. So like all of the buildings that you see throughout London or any city, you put glass in the hands of someone who's not thinking about the orientation and you will have a sauna to live in. It will be very uncomfortable. But again, if you use some of the glass products that are available, that can easily be alleviated through coatings that sort of prevent solar penetration, ventilation that if you're generating heat inside and it gets too hot, you will be able to let it out and so on. But I think you're right. There's far too much of that sort of thoughtless use of glass, with kind of concentrating on the glamour of it to produce beautiful penthouses and other, you know, things that look great and very tempting, but could be very problematic to live in.
And the other funny thing that always strikes me is, you know, that glass gets filthy. That's, you know, if you're not careful. So I've been lucky with Monocle to go to the Middle East a few times. And when you're in somewhere like Qatar, where there is dust blowing off the desert every single day, and you see these huge glass skyscrapers, and they just look muddy. They're just covered in this film of dirt all the time. Is that a really complicated process, do you think, for architects as well, to think about when they're doing buildings of scale, about issues of cleanliness? It becomes a very technical issue, doesn't it? It's not just simply kind of bolting on these windows.
Oh, very. You have to solve those problems in the design. You really can't add those sorts of things on it as a retrofit. So kind of two typical solutions would be to have cranes and, building maintenance units that you can lower over the side of a tall building to physically clean it, have people cleaning it, and or use the new technology of self-cleaning glass, which is semi-unproven, I think, but certainly has a lot of potential, so that the dirt is kind of burnt off by the sun in a catalytic process. And then the secondary coating on the glass, instead of the raindrops forming droplets, they form a sort of sheet of water that washes it off. So that theoretically would solve this sort of problem in the Middle East and elsewhere. Anywhere, in fact, glass gets dirty. So if you don't want a muddy, grotty-looking building, then you have to take that into consideration for sure.
That was author Virginia McLeod speaking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck for this week's pristine, shatterproof, glass-themed urbanist. And you can hear the full interview on the programme, which premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
In the meantime, though, you're with Midori House. We'll be back right after this with our man in Madrid.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for die-hard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves, beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:43 a.m. here in London, and it's time to check in with one of our correspondents who isn't in London, and we'll talk to Liam Aldous. He's our man in Madrid. Liam, welcome back to Midori House. He's finally going to speak, it seems.
Well, he's actually speaking right now.
I'm currently
glued to my screen. I was watching him just a few moments ago. Obviously speaking about Prime Minister Rajoy, who has been avoiding speaking to the media about a corruption scandal that's embroiling his government and has been for the last, since February. His strategy since February has not to even mention Bárcenas, who's the ex-treasurer of the PP, who's been accused of having secret accounting books, paying kickbacks to a variety of ruling PP party ministers, including the Prime Minister. But today he's come out. First of all, it didn't seem seemed to be going very well. He was just talking about how good the economy was going, which is basically not that true, but he was letting off a few statistics, talking about signs of improvement, and it seemed like he was going to avoid the issue once again. But then he came out and just said, okay, let's talk about the Butfinder scandal, and I can summarize it in two words, and those two words are, I'm wrong. I was wrong on three words in English, but in Spanish. <it's good> but anyway, he seemed to be taking the scandal head on and dealing with it head on. He actually even mentioned Bárcenas's name, which he's been avoiding doing for months now. He's actually mentioned that three times now in the entire speech. But then he seemed to have flipped around again, and now he's basically denying all the accusations and trying to put all the blame on Bárcenas, saying that he was wrong in confiding or trusting this man, but all these accusations are wrong, and there's just a defensive strategy to try and bring the government down with him.
So what exactly is he saying, Liam? On the one hand, he's saying that he has made a mistake, but he's actually trying to say that the mistake that he made was not of being corrupt and of accepting payments, but of actually trusting someone who was corrupt.
Exactly. It's kind of an interesting strategy. They're trying to really walking a fine line here. So, yeah, he's basically saying that trusting him all these years and supporting him, because this Bárcenas of the Treasure was quite a confidant of the Prime Minister. This is why he's so heavily attached to this scandal. And he's saying he was wrong in trusting him, and he supported him as he would any other minister who was involved in a scandal until the evidence was clear. So he's saying, basically it's clear that Bárcenas was doing dodgy things, but I wasn't doing anything wrong, and I'm going to deny them forever. And he basically said that his accounts, all of his tax returns, all of his payments and salaries are available for public viewing, and they're much more trustworthy than screwed up pieces of paper, handwritten pieces of paper, as is the evidence of the Bárcenas scandal.
Well, presumably, whichever construction he finds to make his denial, the opposition isn't going to be sated by that. They're presumably going to continue to call for him to go.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing, and if the calls and the interruptions in his speech in the Senate today, while Rajoy is giving a speech, are any sign to go by, they're not that happy, and they have been saying that if he doesn't actually admit that he was wrong and quit, then they will bring on a censure motion, which doesn't really leave much room for compromise, does it? They're basically saying he has to go, and they're not calling for elections. They're saying he has to be replaced with someone else in the PP, which is... at least they're not going to the full extreme. But this scandal will continue to dog the party no matter what Rajoy says today. The Secretary General of the PP, Maria Dolores Cospedal, has actually been called to testify in court on the 14th of August with two other past Secretary Generals. So this is another interesting development. So the PP seems to continuing on its strategy to just avoid any wrongdoing, but the scandal is going to continue to dog them.
Let's move on to the story that has been quite sadly dominating our headlines right across the world in the last week, which is the train crash last week. It's been a drama that has been unfolding piecemeal, day by day. You get more terrible details about the moments running up to the accident.
Yeah, it was just it was a horrible tragedy, actually, and the revelation yesterday that the driver was actually talking on the phone at the moment of the crash is kind of a bombshell. And it was actually a phone call from another person on the train, the conductor on the train, who was calling him to let him know to which platform to stop at because a family at the next station, because a family was going to get off at that station, which is very interesting. The conductor actually said he withheld this information in the beginning because he wanted to protect the driver, but for the time being, all the blame is being shouldered on the driver, and the driver seems to have admitted some responsibility, but there is some questioning about the security systems that were in place, because this section of track, the train was meant to be going at 80 kilometres an hour and was actually going at around 190 kilometres an hour, and there are meant to be security systems in place which are meant to tell the driver to slow down at certain points of the track, because this line is quite interesting. It's part high-speed rail and part normal rail, so the train actually has to speed up and slow down depending on the parts of the track. So This is all calling into question Spain's kind of high-speed rail miracle, which is one of the country's success stories. And there are quite a lot of contracts kind of up in the air at the moment, international contracts, because of this scandal. So you've got the heads of Adif and Renfe kind of staying silent during all this, waiting for the investigation to play out, because they don't want their industry to be damaged and have their contract, the chances for these contracts ruined.
Liam, before you go, we'll talk about a different mode of transport. This is the two-wheel type, the bike rental scheme that I've heard so much about. It's finally got a date, apparently.
Yeah, you've heard so much about it because it's been talked about for the last nearly decade. Madrid has been waiting so long for its bike scheme. It's been put off because of economic difficulties and because of the crisis and a change in mayor. The new mayor, Ana Botella, who's been in power for nearly 2 years now, has actually suddenly, to everyone's surprise, embraced the project and put a date on a bike scheme for Madrid that will be in May next year. So it will be about 1,560 bikes in the first phase. And there will be quite a few anchors, it'll be about 3,000 anchors. People are quite surprised because Madrid hasn't really embraced biking. A lot of people have said that there's a lot of uphill and downhill parts of Madrid and it would never work. But then other people say that it works in San Francisco quite well, so why couldn't it work in Madrid? So the mayor in September will actually announce a more broader policy, announcing more bike lanes. But critics say as well that the bike lane that she will announce, which is basically just a ring road around the city, is not enough because the drivers don't really respect bikers, and if there's no bike lanes, there will be a lot of problems.
Liam, thank you very much indeed, as ever. That was Liam Aldous, our man in Madrid.
Chronicle's editor Andrew Tuck will be with us in a moment with his take on the British front pages. Before that, though, the UK's Tom Adele has wowed critics and fans alike over the past year, adding a Brit Award and a number one debut album to other accolades along the way.
With industry success comes interest from DJs and producers who look to piggyback a specific fan base through remixed versions, so every now and then one hits the mark. And this is Tom Adele with Another Love, remixed by Stefan Zeiser.
Take me somewhere, you know I care, but it's so cold and I don't know where. I brought you daffodils on a pretty string, but they won't flower like they did last spring. And I wanna kiss you, make you feel alright. I'm just so tired to share my nights. I wanna cry.
Tom Adele there with Another Love, remixed by Stefan Zeiser.
Now, you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds. You can hear rustling of papers in the background. That is because...
a sort of drumming on papers.
Our editor, Andrew Tuck, has hot-footed it, but complete with sticky notes on the side of his beautifully marked up papers to tell us what we should be heading towards as we drink our morning coffee.
What's your first sticky note, Andrew?
Okay. I'll confess to being one. I want to know if you're one. Are you a meerkat?
Do you meerkat?
Do I meerkat? Is that a verb?
It's a verb. You can meerkat.
I'm now horrified by that.
Okay. I want to know what that means. I'm very vigilant.
I do it.
Okay.
I'll tell you what
it is. I pop my head up from behind sofas?
You can do it on the sofa. You can certainly do it on the sofa. I've done it on the sofa quite regularly.
Oh, no.
What it's about is, it's a new thing, it's a recognition that actually when we're watching TV,
yes,
nobody really watches TV anymore. They always have, you're like you, the laptop on their lap.
Yes.
So
yes.
Meerkatting is a new verb, and it means, it is the habit known as meerkatting. In some parts of the media industry, this is described as, is when viewers who divert their attention between two screens while sitting in an upright position on the couch.
Because meerkats do that all the time.
Yeah.
Meerkats have all got smartphones these days.
Yeah. They're not very high-tech. They're really good at swiping.
They're tweeting about X Factor while they're watching something else. Yeah, I understand.
Well, the basis of this story is a suggestion that, in fact, there's a revival of the living room. We're all going back to the living room.
Oh,
there's a decline in the number of TVs being bought for children's bedrooms. That the tablet is supposedly bringing us back together. Well, it's not really, because when you read the story, you discover that no one's actually talking to each other, but actually we don't mind being in the same room with each other, as long as we can do two or three things.
So, I mean, that's not great, but it's not as bad as being in separate rooms all glued to a different TV screen, I suppose. I mean, it's hardly like, you know, reforming great human relationships, is it?
I guess it depends how nice your brothers and sisters and parents are. Sometimes it's quite nice to escape to your own bedroom.
I was about to say, at least we know what our family members look like, even if we do this, even if it's only the back of their heads as you can see them.
Second word for the day.
Yes, thank you.
Croppies.
Croppies.
Croppies were the people who made crop circles, and they're called croppies. And
hang on, I thought aliens made crop circles.
Andrew?
No,
here's meerkats.
Matthew Williams, this is perhaps one of the nicest pitch captions ever. Matthew Williams has hung up his stomping board because he now suffers from hay fever.
Oh,
now that's
no.
unfortunate.
So he is behind the majority of these. But anyway, he says, in fact, it's old hat. Nobody's interested in crop circles anymore. They've moved on. Sand circles.
Oh, come on.
They've moved on to sand circles. And so Matthew is apparently responsible for many hundreds of them. There were used to be 10,000 of them over a summer. There have only been 13 so far this summer. And farmers don't like them anymore.
Do you think they're just getting lazy? Or are they too busy on their tablets meerkatting?
No, they're probably meerkatting. He just says it's kind of old hat. There were two, three people that were very responsible for it. A couple of them have gone into computers. One's got
a surprise.
One's gone into sand cropping.
They've all gone indoors.
Okay, well, at least they've got futures.
Time for one more?
Why not? Of course, why not?
Okay. Another word that you need for your... You learn things with me.
We need a glossary for this paper.
How useful it is questionable, but do carry on, Andrew.
Telangana. That is the new name.
That's
the new name for the 29th state in India. They're carving up Andhra Pradesh.
And they're not happy about it.
Not happy at all.
Andhra Pradesh is enormous at this point, isn't it? It's pretty large.
It's bigger than a crop circle. It's vast. But the people who speak Telugu, who live in the north, the north of Andhra Pradesh, they've lobbied for a long time to have their own state because they believe it will allow kind of their people to kind of enter government jobs and it will kind of boost the economy. It's dirt poor, literally dirt poor. It's kind of an area with almost no water. But the people in the south in Andhra Pradesh are very, very angry about it. And they've been
because they're losing a main centre, aren't they?
Yes. And I think it's just also that, you know, you are one of the biggest states in India, and suddenly you have this kind of massive loss of kind of territory and land.
It makes an awful lot of sense.
Identity that goes with it as well.
Yeah. And then maybe just one serious one.
Okay, go on. We're not going to learn any new words this time.
It's not serious at all. It's science, though.
Okay.
Oh, gosh.
This is.
I'm not sure I'm ready for this today.
Hangover is a strain on the brain. Now, this is just one of those things you can't believe that somebody's investigated. This is the conclusion of a group of scientists who have spent doing work that I've done already. It says, a hangover leaves you with more than a sore head in the morning. It also impairs the brain's ability to hold and process information.
Roger that.
And
yep.
How thorough were their investigations in the process of establishing this?
Well, Keele University have certainly put some resources behind it, apparently.
Ah, Keele.
And I'm not sure if all the research was done in the Union Bar.
Yeah.
But they've come to this very big conclusion.
I'm pretty sure I did that project at university as well and came to the same conclusion.
Some people at Monocle are still helping.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Does this mean that we can now stop drinking
heavily, Andrew?
It's an ongoing process.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed for your most informative paper review of today. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer Tom Lewis and our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Falco, and to our studio manager too, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is Culture with Robert Bound.
Now, Emma will be back with Mr. Phil Hahn for tomorrow's edition of Midori House, but for now, from me, Dominic Reynolds,
and from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.